Hello and welcome to the Catholic Book Club podcast. We have a bit of an introduction this month to our selection, which is an older novel originally written in Japanese by Shusaku Endo. The name of the novel is Silence. And together here with me to discuss the book is Jim Keane, who is the acquiring editor of books at Orbis Books, a work of the Mary Knoll fathers in the United States. Jim, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
A couple of weeks ago, well, two months ago now, Martin Scorsese met with a number of Jesuits from the Northeast at Fordham Prep and discussed his project of making this novel, Silence, into a major motion picture. And when he was discussing why he was captivated, describing why he was captivated by this novel, he said it reminded him of all of his previous work in which he thinks about characters who are caught between what they ought to do and what they have to do. Probably thinking about guys from his old neighborhood, maybe down in Little Italy, who have to do certain things to survive, to support a family. How do those two questions apply to this novel, just as an overarching moral framework? How does this map on to a Portuguese priest who comes to Japan on fire with the desire to extend the faith that was brought to Japan by St. Francis Xavier, and, if it must happen, to be martyred, to die trying to manifest the faith of Jesus Christ? Is there in this character those questions, what I have to do and what I ought to do?
Yeah, I think that not just in this character, but also in kind of his main antagonist, which is the Japanese local overlord, which is Inoue. Both of them, you know, have aspects of this struggle in their expression or in their own hearts. And in the case of Inoue, he basically wants to stamp out Christianity, which he sees as his duty. And he seems to take a certain amount of delight in it. I mean, it doesn't seem like a conflicted character. But in Rodriguez, our protagonist, he comes with these visions of what martyrdom will be. And that is something that he thinks he can undertake. What happens is that he gets tricked in a way by Inoue to the point where his own martyrdom is not going to be him suffering for the glory of God, but in fact him listening while innocent villagers who are also Christians are tortured until he apostatizes. And so in the novel, you definitely see him decide, without ever being physically tortured at all, to capitulate, to apostatize, to stamp on the face of Jesus in this fumie, this plaque that is used to force Christians to apostatize, because he really feels that is at the moment what he ought to do. And that, of course, then leads to 30 years of looking back on this. And the novel can be, I think, at certain points ambivalent about what that character's own purpose was for doing this. Did he do it as a hero? Did he do it as a coward? But certainly, I think it is framed in those ways in the novel itself. So it makes for very ripe fruit for Scorsese. I mean, Scorsese has some villains who seem to really glory in their villainy, you know, Frank Costello or someone like that. But then he does have these other characters who are caught by their ties to the old neighborhood, to the old faith, to the police, to whatever organization they're part of. And you can see it would be natural material for him.
It seems also in the novel there are a couple of clear distinctions, a distinction between weak and strong, ugly and beautiful, and the way that those two distinctions, they line up with one another. Weakness is ugly, and it's personified by Judas, and in this novel, a character, Kichi Jiro, who continuously betrays Christians to the authorities and causes them to be tortured. and also betrays his own faith. He is a manifestation of Judas, and he's ugly. And there are times throughout the novel where Rodriguez sees his face as an ugly coward's face. And Rodriguez also has these reminisces about the face of Christ throughout the novel.
Right, which is an important part of his spirituality, right?
He sees the Bible as silent. The Gospels are silent in giving some indication of what Jesus looked like, so he allows his imagination to fill in the details. And he imagines Jesus as having a gentle, compassionate face, a strong face, a beautiful face. And as he goes out throughout the novel, it's almost like an extended passion. I mean, this novel reminds me of the Gospel of Mark in some ways, where the passion is two-thirds of the story. Here, Rodriguez's own sufferings is two-thirds of the novel. And in the end, he steps on the face of Christ, his beloved face, the face that he has erected in his own imagination as a face of strength, but gentleness, warmth, incorruptibility, and he still crushes or tramples on that face, that beauty, that strength. And he himself becomes Judas. Not even Peter, but Judas. So just if you have any thoughts on the face of Christ, and it's how it morphs, how it transforms, how those categories are eradicated in the end, how those clear distinctions of heroine or a hero and betrayer are blurred.
Right. Well, I think if the character of Kichijiro, who you mentioned, is to me straight out of Graham Greene, The Power and the Glory, if you remember the character of the half-caste, who is described in very vivid terms by Graham Greene. It sort of haunted me my whole life, this image of his big toe sticking through the sneaker and the one tooth sticking out of his mouth. He's kind of shown as this vicious, degraded, sort of corrupt character who will do anything to sell out the priest in that novel. And as you mentioned, in that novel, The Power and the Glory, that character exactly plays the role of Judas. He gets his pieces of silver for selling out this Jesus figure. The difference is, of course, is that the result in that novel is the priest, despite his own failings, somehow contributes to the glory of God and the church and is replaced by other priests who are inspired by his example. Whereas in Silence, the character of Kichijiro, who does repeatedly sell out not just this priest protagonist, Rodriguez, but also a number of other Christians, keeps coming back. There's no moment where he is conveniently disposed of. He returns to the story over and over again, including at the end to demand confession from this defrocked priest. And I think that in a way, it complicates it much more. And my own suspicion is that has to do with Endo's own vision of who Christ is to Rodriguez and maybe to himself, in the sense that Rodriguez uses as his excuse for why he tramples on the image of Christ, that Christ actually says to him, "Go ahead and trample on me. This is why I came onto the earth. This is why I became incarnate, so that I might be trampled on to save others." And so there's a sense, it's not clear to me that that's exactly what Endo is trying to say, but there's a sense in which the priest tries to justify, Rodriguez tries to justify his actions by saying, by trampling on this image of Christ, I saved these other people. And therefore, in doing so, I mimicked the kenosis of Jesus Christ. I did these things. So yes, there is a Judas in my background, but yes, I did what Christ said. Now, there is no redemption really for the priest or for those Christians. If you read the appendix to the book, it's clear that the persecutions continue. It's clear that Inoue will not stop before Christianity is completely obliterated from Japan. And it's clear, if you read this as a historical novel, that in a sense, the missions did not succeed, which complicates the matter, is that the Judas figure, in a way, is not the goat. He actually is... continues to play an active role in the story and continues sort of to haunt Father Rodriguez, who is not really depicted. If you want to talk about Scorsese here and you want to talk about these very bold, obvious Christ figures that Scorsese likes to use in his movies, well, it's hard sometimes to see Rodriguez as a Christ figure. He seems in some ways to have sold out Christ for his own interpretation of what Christ wanted him to do, which I don't know if we can read Endo as saying that's because that's what he did as a psychological move, or that's because Christ wanted from him.
It seems like Rodriguez's faith, his own understanding of himself, is quite self-important, quite strident. But there's also the sense that Christ has come for those who need healing, those who are ugly, those who are like Kichijiro. And I want to read a passage toward the beginning where I think Rodriguez is still this strident European priest coming to ensure that Japan stays true to the European Christianity that was planted there originally by Xavier and the first generation of missionaries. And he's thinking about a baptism that he has just performed. And he's thinking about the nature of the life of the peasants that he have been Christian for a couple of generations now. And I want to read this from page 38 in my edition. "This child also would grow up like its parents and grandparents to eke out a miserable existence face to face with the Black Sea in this cramped and desolate land. It, too, would live like a beast, and like a beast it would die. But Christ did not die for the good and beautiful. It is easy enough to die for the good and beautiful. The hard thing is to die for the miserable and corrupt. This is the realization that came home to me acutely at that time, at the time of right. baptism." There's a lot there. There's a European looking at Japanese peasantry and deeming them beasts, right. having a beastly existence. But there's also an insight into Christ that I think is interesting. Maybe you could talk about that. But further, does that understanding of Jesus Christ coming for the ugly and the corrupt, is that a permissive Christ? Is that like the father in the story of the prodigal son, where he knows that the son is a wastrel? And you know, almost endangers him. Is this an odd, permissive way of looking at Jesus Christ in relation to sin?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I noticed that the edition you have of the book is the one with William Johnston did the introduction and the translation. William Johnston was a very prominent Jesuit who worked in Japan for many years, and one of the things that Johnston wrote about in his own autobiography is that Endo was a baptized Catholic, baptized at 12, lived his life as a Catholic, lived in France for some time studying the French novelists, and always saw Christianity as this sort of weird alien thing that was trying to transplant itself into Japan and failing. But Johnston noted that near the end of his life, Endo wrote a novel about a group of priests in India. And Johnston sees this as, he casts this as kind of Endo's attempt to forge an Asian Christianity instead of a Japanese Christianity. But the hero of that book is a Japanese Catholic priest. And Johnston notes this is exactly what Endo always loved, which was the freak, which was this sort of Flannery O'Connor-esque person who was just completely out of place. And there are a number of reasons. I mean, if we want to go the cheap route and go autobiographical, Endo himself was sick his entire life. You know, he had a lung removed, he had pleurisy, he had tuberculosis, he was always in terrible health. And did that somehow contribute to this? Then if we just want to talk about it as a thematic thing, I think there is a sense in which Christ for Endo is the Christ of the cripple, is the Christ of the circus freak, of the outsider. And in a situation like the Japan, which he's writing about in Silence, it's an almost completely homogenous society. And so you take a character like Rodriguez or Pereira, the other priest who had been Rodriguez's great hero, well, these are Europeans who literally, in the context of Japan, are freaks. They look completely different from everyone else. And as you mentioned, they have this European mindset. I mean, it can be painful to read those passages where he's describing these people as basically no more than animals. Mm-hmm. I mean, that they touch rice twice a year. Otherwise, they eat rotten fish and, you know, live lives in squalor. I mean, it can be...
with horrible breath and...
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, they're described in very negative terms. And, you know, as a reader, you try and, you know, disassociate Endo from the voice of the narrator or the protagonist. But, I mean, I was uncomfortable with some of those passages. And I think that that gets to the heart of what Endo's image of Christ is, what Christ is for him. And it's not this cosmic Christ or this triumphant Christ that you see on the back wall of the Sistine Chapel coming in triumph. Instead, it is a very human Christ, a Christ who, if you want to quote Rodriguez, came to be trampled on and associates with those people the most.
I can understand, and I think it's holy, it makes sense, where Christ has come for the sick, the crippled, the misfit. But there's a difference between that and the corrupt. There's a malice in the corrupt. And I wonder if that understanding of the humanity of Christ and its concern even for the corrupt, is that permissive?
Right. Right. I think that, I mean, by permissive you mean basically making Christ
countenance.
An excuse for poor behavior.
Right. And further sin.
Right.
And, you know, Christianity can be made into a legalistic religion. It can be made into, you know, I have done, I've checked all the boxes, I've been righteous and good, and I've gone to Mass. And that's a distortion of the heart of the faith. But is it also a distortion to say that Christ identifies with and countenances sinners? Not sinners themselves, but the behavior of the sinful, the malicious, the corrupt, Inoue. Is he also part of Christ's saving work? Judas, there's a proximity between Jesus and Judas. There is a relationship there. Jesus chooses Judas, and you know there's a terribly complicated relationship between Jesus and Judas, which this novel takes on.
Right.
But can Christ, who's come to save sinners, also countenance a malicious corruption?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, there's a point in the novel where, you know, Rodriguez is repeatedly returning to this question of what did Jesus mean when he said to Judas, what you're going to do, do it quickly.
Right.
And there's a point near the end where he says, well, what he meant was, well, he's actually having a dialogue with Christ. And Christ says, I knew Judas was suffering. I wanted to get it over with. And that Christ is certainly just seeking sort of prompt succor for Judas, not saying you're going to play a role in the continued corruption of the world. But I do think that there is an ambiguity there. Rodriguez knows that he's considered contemptible by his fellow Jesuits after his apostasy, the apostate Paul, is what the Japanese call him. And so the question is that, you know, do we have a reversal of a Graham Greene scenario where instead of this man contributing to sort of this, the blood of the martyr being the seed of faith, is the betrayal of the priest actually contrary to the faith? Is that, are you you know, basically cooperating with sin? Inoue is a different character, I think, because there are times in the book when Inoue mimics Christian virtues, but for the purpose of evil. He grants hospitality. He calls the priest father. He says, "I'm going to send you to live in my own house. I'm going to, you know, the persecutions will stop." But those are all for the purposes of continuing to destroy the faith of believers in the island. And so it would be a hard thing for me to go back to your point, to see him in Endo's mind or in the intention for the audience as being someone who is participating in Christ's saving work. I mean, he is in many ways sort of a character without very many redeeming qualities.
So there's an ambiguity with Rodriguez that can that can actually somehow contribute to the faith, or at least a richer understanding of the faith, and perhaps a richer understanding of the relationship of Judas in Jesus. Let's step back for a bit and just talk about this as a piece of writing. It's a strange combination of voices here. There's letters that seem like the direct report of Rodriguez himself, probably writing to either his superior in Macau or back home. Then there's a third-person, omniscient, I would say, depiction of the latter part of Rodriguez's imprisonment and torture and finally his apostasy. And then there's this strange appendix that is written, well, there are two appendixes, basically. There's a Dutch merchant's diary, right, and then there's a Japanese soldier from whom we get about 30 years compressed into staccato reports, almost like a house log.
Right.
So just as a piece of writing, how does that all fit together, and does it work?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would agree with you. It's very odd in the sense that it's very postmodern for a 1966 novel to have that element where there's no respect at all for a single narrative voice. I think that you have, my own suspicion is that what Endo was trying to do is that when you get these staccato terse reports, these are trying to show the monotony, the ordinariness of a life after this momentous event, after this apostasy that Rodriguez has committed, which is in a way how Father Pereira describes his own life. I have someone else's wife now. I live someone else's life. I
someone else's name, even.
I have someone else's name, right? And I think that as a narrative strategy, that's what Endo was after. It can be very jarring because you feel like you are, sometimes the transitions are not great. You feel like, well, wait, who is speaking here? It's interesting to see. I'm not familiar with his earlier novels. He wrote a novel called, I think the Japanese translation to English is basically The White People, which is about, you know, foreigners coming to Japan. I'd love to see if he had experimented with that previously, because certainly it would have been out of place at its time.
Do you think the different narrative forms imply a different degrees of honesty? You know, there's almost like a self-illusion, self-delusion in the letters that Rodriguez pens himself. Does the account get more honest as the novel goes on?
Because the facts don't lie.
Right. Or yeah. The form doesn't lie.
Right, right. Well, I think there's one of the central tensions of this book is to question whether or not Rodriguez heard that voice,
right,
when he stamped on the image of Christ. Christ saying to him, go ahead and do it. Or was that a justification? Is Inoue right? You know, is this just a coward? Or is this someone who is, you know, has his own reasons for privileging the life of these other people who are being tortured and justifies it that way? But, you know, did he hear it or didn't he? You know, there's a, sometimes you have these figures who, for example, William Johnston, again, the translator, speaks about his own life as a mystical journey with these moments of one of them he calls the Kundalini experience, where he feels this incredible energy come up through him, which a Buddhist would describe as this Kundalini experience, which he really attributes to sort of the unmerited grace of God, the moment of, you know, consolation without cause. Hmm. Endo doesn't really seem in his writing, at least not in this book, to express any notion of that. There's no consolation without cause amid the monotony of the flies and the right. Rain and the the lead sea and the bad breath of your everyday Christian.
The last act that Rodriguez performs in the book is a confession. He hears the confession of Kajijiro. And I wonder, he's heard this guy's confession before. I wonder how Rodriguez has changed as the sacramental minister. He's disgraced, yet there is in him a different understanding of the sin before him because he's lived it.
Right.
There's no more barrier between him and the sinner.
Right.
And there's a line toward the end, Kichijiro wept softly. This is just after the confession. Then he left the house. The priest had administered that sacrament that only the priest can administer. And throughout the novel, Rodriguez is seeing himself as useful. His
right.
life has value and meaning because he's working as a priest. And he says, the worst thing in the world for a priest is not to measure up, not to be able to work as a priest. And he also sees himself as the last bulwark of Christianity on the island of Japan and sees maybe, perhaps, instead of martyrdom, a life of service to these Christians is more important than an immediate death.
Right.
So I'll continue. No doubt his fellow priests would condemn his act as sacrilege. But even if he was betraying them, he was not betraying his Lord. He loved him now in a different way from before.
Right. As far as Endo intends it, I have no lack of certainty that that's supposed to be the kenosis hymn. This is the emptying out of this man to become exactly like Kichijiro with his foul breath and his many sins and his treachery. And I think there's another line, maybe a couple lines later from that, where he says, I am the last priest in this country.
Right.
Which is to say, I am the priest of this country, which is to say, I am the high priest of this country. And I think that there is a definite connection there with Endo's own notions of what Christ came to do. And I think that feeds back into what you said earlier about the danger of, you know, do you baptize corruption, you know? But that is, in Endo's mind, Rodriguez experiencing the emptying out that happens in Philippians.
There are two images that are used to describe Christianity in Japan. The first is an image of a sapling, which is planted in a swamp. It thrives for a bit, and then it just can't continue. And when Rodriguez apostatizes, Inoue says, the root has been cut. Now the tree will certainly die. There's also an interesting image for Christianity as somewhat like a lover constantly harassing the beloved, and the beloved doesn't want to respond in love. Or I think the image here is an ugly woman constantly harassing
mm-hmm.
Somebody who rejects the love but continues to pester and harass and throw himself or herself on Japan. And Japan simply doesn't want it.
Right.
What do you think of those two images for missiology, for Christianity being planted in another context?
Yeah, well, I think this is alluded to in the novel to some degree, is that there is the suggestion that it's not that Japan doesn't want Christianity, is that Japan suggests, perhaps correctly, that Christianity is in some ways the first wave of the traders, the galleons with the slaves and the cannons, and this is reinforced by the Dutch and the English telling everyone these Spanish and these Portuguese, they're just bandits. You know, the priests are their first wave; they're the craftiest of them all. And certainly that's been the black legend for the Society of Jesus forever, is that there's another motive there. And so I think that in the case of Japan, is that does Inoue hate Christianity, or does he hate what he sees as foreign interlopers who are going to destroy his way of life. The second thing I would say to that is that I was at a conference over the summer, a missiology conference for my work, and one of the speakers there, Peter Fahn, prominent missiologist based at Georgetown, said, playing off of the old phrase, extra ecclesiam nulla salus, with outside the church there is no salvation. He said, extra migrantes nulla salus, is that outside the immigrant there is no salvation. And his point was that throughout Christian history, the immigrant brings the church. And that we have these images from the Mediterranean in the early centuries of the church of Christus Mercator, Christ the merchant, Christ who comes on the ship and brings good things. But if you look at the case of Japan, one of the things that William Johnston talked about is that what is happening now, and actually Johnston wrote this 30 years ago, so what was happening 30 years ago, but presumably is still happening now, is that with a declining birth rate and its integration into a global economy, this closed Japan, which was the image of Endo's novel, is now an opening Japan. Not an open one, but an opening one. And there are huge numbers of Filipinos and Koreans and Nigerians and Indians, who many of whom are Catholic, in Japan now. And so Johnston has this line where he says, how many Japanese men marry Filipino women before suddenly Christianity is not the weird sapling, but in fact something that grows alongside a Buddhism, grows alongside a Shintoism, grows alongside a Zen understanding of the world, grows alongside an animism, grows alongside secularism. And so it is interesting to me, in terms of missiology, that experience is going to change Japan, and it would be a different novel if Endo wrote it today.
Jim, you've taught quite a bit in the past. You've taught courses on Catholic novels. Tell me about teaching this novel to kids in university. Do they get it? Do they like it? Do they revile Rodriguez? Or how do they? What was it like to teach this book to students?
Yeah, well, it was a mixed bag, because the context in which I was teaching this was a course on Catholic novels. I taught at Fordham and then at University of San Francisco. And the protagonists of those novels were often priests, and they varied in their in the author's depiction of them. So obviously we would read The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene, where the priest is incapable of even the smallest acts of virtue in a lot of ways, is a slave to addiction, is a slave to his own passions. But in the simple act of just following his priesthood, becomes a martyr for the faith and the seed to bring forth new priests. Then we would read things like Morta Urban by J.F. Powers, okay, where the priest, in the simple act of just succumbing to his priestly prerogatives, is corrupted in this insidious way that is fun to read but increasingly dreadful, and in fact only becomes, only redeems himself in both Morta Urban and then again in Wheat That Springeth Green, the next the novel Powers published 40 years later, in both cases by taking the somewhat eccentric step of abandoning his priestly prerogatives and becoming incredibly humbled. So I would have students who would go one way or the other, right? To be a priest is to be a hero, versus, you know, to treat your life as an act of heroism is an incredible arrogation, is an incredible act of arrogance. And so there would be a mixed bag about this. I mean, I would have some students who would say that Rodriguez gave up his life for those three people hanging in the pit, and that is the only thing that, you know, should be expected of him. And other people who, you know, in one case is someone who is now a Jesuit seminarian, who said, no, Christ doesn't ask Rodriguez to be responsible for their salvation. You're responsible for your own salvation and then the help of souls. And, you know, we would have some interesting discussions around that. When Rodriguez stamps on the image of Christ to save those people, does he doom them? Were they better off dying? And, you know, sometimes college kids can think in very black and white terms. Sometimes also they can have an a very hard time, in my own opinion, seeing the image of someone who deals with a great deal of a sense that their life has been a failure. I think that sometimes in the novels they want a hero. It's very hard, I think, maybe in American culture writ large, to have Superman fail, to have Batman die. You know, it doesn't happen. You know, Thor is dead, and then in the last scene of that movie, suddenly, you know, comes to life for no reason, you know. And I think that they're, in some ways, American culture wants that superhero, and so it can be hard for them to see Rodriguez or see a J.F. Powers protagonist.
Do you think they could ever trample the face of Superman? Thor, could they ever bring themselves to do that?
Well, and you know, that jokes aside, this is a question I think that anyone who struggles very sincerely with their faith asks themselves when they read this novel. Right. What would I do?
Or where, at what point would I give up?
Right.
Or would I be able to withstand that intense suffering?
Right.
And really, for the entire novel up to the ending, this what Rodriguez feels is the silence of God.
Yes.
You know, why, God, why are you burdening these people in this way? Why can't the... Okay, you've done enough of... You've caused... Because there's a real sense that God is ultimately governing the province that includes this suffering. So it is a part of God's providence.
Yeah.
So at what point, if there remains silence from God, at what point would me, the reader, or me, the Christian, flip and trample?
And I think that if you are a student of Catholic history and you know that a young Jesuit like Rodriguez would have been fed on a steady diet of stories of martyrdoms, heroic every time. I mean, there would be no stories of a pathetic martyrdom or a failed martyrdom. This is the blood of the martyrs is the seed of faith. It would be what he had heard, and in some ways, the strict training he would have undergone as a Jesuit would have been intended as a preparation for him to withstand physical torture and mental abuse. And this is maybe a perverse example, but I think of The Sopranos. Pauly Walnuts is one of my favorite characters from The Sopranos, the sort of eccentric uncle of the family. And he's reminiscing at one point and worrying about himself because he's seen his friends go to jail or face being killed by their opponents and these things. And he says, when my time comes, will I stand up? And I think that is the in some ways the question that a reader is faced with in a novel like this. It's like, well, put yourself in Rodriguez's shoes. You know, what do you do?
Yeah. But I think Pauly Walnuts decides, is questioning, is doubting, because he really begins to dislike Tony, his boss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he feels loved by Tony, I think that would strengthen him. And I think you can analogously include the relationship between Christ and Rodriguez.
Well, sorry to interrupt you, but what that brings up is the question of part of the reason Rodriguez has gone to Japan is that he must redeem the reputation of Pereira, who is his great hero and his father in some sense. And Pereira, he cannot believe, has apostatized. Pereira was his hero in school and went over there as this learned, I mean, a samurai in some ways. And so I think that you know, is germane to your point about Tony Soprano and Pauly Walnuts, is that Rodriguez gets there and he hears rumors. He doesn't know.
Right.
It's not as black and white as he thought.
And that face of Ferreira is another face that he absolutely loves, he adores. And he can't imagine those European blue eyes disgraced and humiliated. And he says, and it's stated at the beginning of the novel, I am going to redeem the honor, and he uses that word,
yes,
the honor of our faith, and implied in that, the honor of European culture.
Right.
And everything European Christianity and his priesthood, and he has to go and redeem that somehow, or at least make sure that Ferreira has indeed disgraced himself in that way.
Right.
To have proof
right.
of that, why, and then to redeem.
Right, right. And when he meets with Pereira, they have these encounters where they not necessarily even looking at each other in the face, because that image of the face of the beloved is too hard, too hard for Rodriguez to deal with. And Pereira seems to have figured out a coherent system of thought that explains his apostasy, but he still can't look Rodriguez in the face when he explains it.
Hmm. James, thanks so much for coming to America today and discussing this novel. I hope it was a fun discussion for you, and I hope it will be enjoyable for our listeners. And I'm sure you look forward to the Scorsese film as much as I do, just to see how it's depicted
Absolutely.
On film.
Absolutely.
And maybe we'll have a discussion on the film in the months ahead.
All right, great. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Thanks, Jim.